Thank you for tuning in to this message from Kingdom Heirs International, headquarters located in Flagstaff, Arizona.
All right, I'm going to keep it pretty brief because I'm very, very excited to sit under Amber and Jason. And part of the reason why is because I know what I'm fighting for. So when Gabe says, do something different and don't get tired, what he's speaking to is the spirit that you are fighting. You're literally fighting a spirit that's trying to keep you in a place that would make you weary and worn out and tired so that you don't come fully to life. We're not dealing with earth. In the sense of, I've had a long, stressful week. You're coming out of a state of death. You're coming out of a system that has dulled your senses and has numbed you to things that actually matter. So the things that aren't as significant as things of the kingdom take precedence in your life. And then when you get to the things of the kingdom, you have nothing left to give, which is what he's trying to pull us out of. And it takes your response or your engagement and your activation in every word that's come prior. And I guarantee more of that is coming in the word tonight. So going back to last week, at every time we gather, we should be a little bit more alive than we were the week before. Because we're given the actual, it's like if you were in quicksand and you were beginning to go deeper and deeper and deeper, and Yahweh threw you a rope and was pulling you out every week, you are less weighed down by that system of death, and you are more free to move and and receive that invitation into life than you were prior. So I just want to remind us really quick of what that looked like last week. Last Saturday, when we were together for Hanukkah, the portion ended up being about expansion. And it was expansion in the context of coming out of the system of death and the invitation into life literally being expanded on.
Yeah.
Right? We see expansion in so many different contexts. But last week, what Dad released over us and sent us into was a 30-day period of mourning. And that mourning was, if you have been operating as a victim, if you have been walking in rejection, if you have been walking in accusation, it may be because he is leading you differently than he did in seasons prior, where his objective was to just keep you alive.
Right.
Or his objective was to rescue you again and again out from Egypt so that you could live just long enough to be able to even open your eyes and recognize there's a fullness of life and an abundance of life that he has for me. That's where we are now. But if we don't recognize that the way that he's leading us has changed, then we could feel like we're being left behind, or we're being dismissed, or we're being ignored, or we're being rejected, or the attention that we've grown accustomed to isn't being fully given to us, when it's this incredible gift to no longer be in a place where you're barely alive. I don't want to have to continue to be rescued over and over and over again, and Yahweh keep resuscitating me because I'm like so such a zombie that he's like, breathe, breathe, breathe. I need your heart to beat. I don't want to be that dead, and I don't want to be asleep. I want him to feel like he has permission as a father and as a leader to lead me differently, because I'm no longer so dead that his objective is, I've just got to keep my daughter alive.
That's good.
Versus, okay, daughter, you're alive. But there's so much more life, you have no idea. So I need you to do what it takes and what I say so that you can have that fullness and abundance of life. That's what we're in the middle of right now, of mourning whatever we thought being led looked like, because it was for a season, and now we're in a completely new, amazing season where the abundance is being made known to us, and we get to recognize that was actually still death to slavery, and now I get to experience a fullness that I didn't know was possible.
That's good.
So whatever that looks like, for that to continue to be extended, that invitation to us tonight, is what we get to continue. It's like that. It's like more of that rope out of that quicksand that we get to keep grabbing a hold of and getting pulled out of. But it's just as easy to let go of the rope and be like, you know what?
Right.
I'm just going to sink back in, which is what Gabe's talking about when it comes to the tiredness or whatever. Just be aware that there is a spirit over the house or over our lives as we come out of what we've known into what he's calling us to, and we have to fight for that life that's being offered. Okay? So part of when I was starting out by saying, I know what I'm fighting for, so I'm excited to sit under Amber and Jason, because in every conversation that I ever have with Amber and Jason, it invites me more into the fullness of that fight.
Yeah.
Meaning they know how to fight for life. And I trust them with the fight over my very own life, knowing that one of the things they do and that they give their lives for is to make sure that I don't just not die, but that I see the dangers around me, the warnings around me, what it is that could keep me from that fullness. So there's invitation, there's always invitation, even every warning that they bring, every guardrail, it's all about life. Just as much as it can feel like it's about correction, it is absolutely 100% an invitation into that life. And so I'm excited to sit under that, because I know whatever is going to come from them is because they sit in a place to safeguard death and life, and that there's meant to be a separation, and they know it well, and they know what it looks like to fight for it, because they do it in their lives every day and on behalf of us. So
yeah, that's good.
Thank you. I'm glad everybody's like scooted in real close. We were thinking about we were talking about it on the way here, and thinking like, if we were given permission at some point to like teach like armory or like do what we would do tonight, like we would on a Thursday,
tourniquet,
then we would make sure that everybody was like pulled in close. And so it's cool. It feels good to have everybody like pulled in real close. How's everybody doing this week?
Good.
You're good?
Good. We're good.
Okay. Well, I appreciate everything that, we appreciate everything, Gabe, that you said, everything you said, Megan. It really is humbling, and just extremely honoring in any context, in any setting, whatever it is, to just be sitting in front of people in general. It's a really, like, I know everybody could attest to it in their own ways, but it's a nerve-wracking thing to have to, like, speak to people. But what I want to say in that is I just want to make sure that like we're doing our part to just take everything that was said, and we don't want to do anything but turn that honor completely around the other way, and just make sure that even though they're not here tonight, obviously mom and dad, the Brewer family as a whole, but what they've done to set a platform for us is the only reason that we've been raised and been matured to a place to do anything. And so even though they're not here, I think they're tuning in. I don't know if they're on or not, but them not being here, just want to make sure that it's honored and it's stated that it is because of the sacrifice that they've over and over and over again have committed to, that any of this is here. So in addition to that, I thought it was cool if I could just like tack on to something you were saying, Gabe, when you were highlighting being engaged to the word. Everybody remember, like we've talked about, in the Hebrew culture, in Western culture, when you're engaged to somebody, it's still optional, right? If somebody pops the question, you say yes. There's still like a trial period, you know? you can still back out of it. But engagement in the Hebrew culture meant like that was the covenant, mm-hmm. like that was the beginning of it. But the marriage being becoming official and being consecrated was like that next step, right? And so it just kind of made me think of like if we're engaged to the word, it's multifaceted. It's not just a like shift in focus. But like if I shift my focus and engagement to Amber, that's like a covenant.
She just laughed.
I can't look at her. That's a like full commitment to covenant from that point forward, right?
Yeah.
So it kind of makes you think, at least it made me think of like, if I'm not engaged to the word, what am I engaged to? Is ultimately that could highlight what I'm creating covenants with that's outside of what he intends, you know? So that was a little heavy to think about, but really, really good to share that. You guys will have to forgive the both of us as we talk, because I think that we're both just kind of like a little bit raspy still, so I might have to pause a few times. You guys like my note taking here?
I love it.
I got the kids' iPad. I was really frustrated at like putting all my notes on here.
Yeah.
I like taking notes on the phone because I can
yeah.
organize it in bullet points
yeah.
and make it really clean. But then it's like this tiny little screen. And I don't have my own iPad, so I'm using the homeschool tools right now.
We're at homeschool.
He's either, yeah. We said armory style, so it's like going home. So. No, I think tonight's going to be cool because there. If I could just outline a couple like intentions or like a roadmap for tonight. Coming off of last weekend with Dad teaching on the last Torah portion over Hanukkah and. Everything that he got into, there were, it could have been a time thing. It could have been that he just had a very solidified vision. I mean, the word that came from that was absolutely pivotal.
Yeah.
You highlighted it in your opening, Megan. It was like huge. It was a. We say it every week, but really, it was another monumental word that I think is solidifying and bringing the portions bringing clarity
yeah.
to where Yahweh has us
yeah.
and. Because of that, we received a ton of direction. There was a couple like things that we wanted to highlight from the last portion. So we'll hit on a few of those things and we'll dot connect a little bit to come into this week. And then we'll touch on this week's tour portion. And she's got some things that she'll kind of follow up with. And we'll probably bounce off each other a little bit. If any of the teens know with Armory, it's never like I'm just talking the whole time and she's absent. But we tend to like play off of each other, so we'll definitely probably do this Armory style. So we may crack some jokes, we may throw some things at you, we may have some fun, but it'll be good. All right. So just to like continue and like, not that the tone hasn't already been set, but just to continue in like kind of reframing our minds, coming out of a week of a portion, you have work, you have the mess of the holidays and the craziness that comes from that and all those things, and then we're like, we're back at it again, right? We're back together in this divine window of time.
Mm-hmm.
So just to kind of like continue framing where we're at right now. Remember that, you know, looking for more of him to provide, right?
Yes.
But we know that we are absolutely given everything that is needed to move, to multiply, to
yes.
mature, all those
right.
things.
Yeah.
We know that we're not striking the rock over and over
yes.
again, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not only from a place of disobedience, but from a place of obedience, I should say,
yeah.
In knowing what he is calling us to do and activating yeah. that directly, right?
Yeah.
Remember Dad's word from last week, every time we gather is a divine window
yeah.
of time.
Mm-hmm.
But just like a window will open and close,
yes.
this time, this portion of our readiness ratio is that divine window of time, and it will come to a close. Now, that's not to say that we can't revisit things and continue to go back and reaffirm things, but just like Gabe was highlighting with engagement, everything Megan said in her opening, take every chance you can to stay focused, tune in, stay alert, open your heart, whatever it was that was on that card, and just continue to like hammer that in, okay? Something that, if I could just put it out there for all of us to be chewing on, thinking about in terms of like of activating. This is something that I'll personally think about a lot. So if you could just keep it in the back of your mind. You guys remember a couple weeks ago we talked about that feedback loop, that there's this loop that you can get caught in. Mm-hmm. And sometimes all it takes to get out of like a negative feedback loop is just to kind of like throw a wrench in the gears or break the chain slightly, and then it all comes apart and you kind of snap out of it and you're like, oh, that's what I need to focus on. Something to be thinking about that maybe could help that feedback loop that you may or may not be in. I'm not saying it's like a blanket statement, but just something in terms of being activated tonight to carry in the word itself, but then moving from tonight, is that hard things make you stronger. That's a super obvious statement, right? Like, do hard things. That's like the message that's out there everywhere today. There's all these influencers. There's all these things out there. There's all this motivation. And it's all talk unless it's acted on, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a common message, right? Like, do hard things. Hard things make you stronger. Embrace the suck. Struggle. Whatever it is. Something that I want to... This is like the nerdy side of the brain that gets really excited about this stuff. But not only is that a powerful statement, but science supports this. Bear with me. You don't have to note this. There was, I don't know how recent, like in the past few years, there's been discovery that there's a portion of your brain. I think that this is totally like God ordained. Obviously, every part of our body is, but I think that the way that this is like being articulated in like a scientific sense completely affirms like what the Torah portions are meant to do. But there's this portion of your brain called the anterior cingulate cortex. And it's this tiny little thing in your brain that actually grows or shrinks when you make conscious, hard decisions. And it's not just that if somebody forces you to do something, like if I got to do chores or whatever and somebody makes me do it, that doesn't activate it. Somebody. But when you make a conscious, hard decision, like you're going to take the cold shower, you're going to wake up early and do the workout, you're going to activate the portion, you're going to let it read you to the fullest extent, and you're going to change something hard in your life. When you make conscious, hard decisions, that piece of your brain actually grows, and then the next set of hard decisions is easier. I say that in quotes because it's not like suddenly everything's easy. You still have to make hard decisions. But it grows and it builds momentum, essentially, is what is the concept behind it. So as it grows, your ability to more rapidly make hard decisions gets expanded. However, there's also a direct inverse, that doesn't make any sense. There's an inverse relationship that when you consciously make a poor or easy or escape decision, whatever it is, it shrinks. And then it cascades the other way. So it's like it increases exponentially this way or it goes that way. Wow. So it's like as you make conscious, weak decisions, it actually gets easier and easier and easier to make those decisions, and you just plummet in that direction. So science supports what the Torah portions are like highlighting in all of this, right? We're making hard decisions to come out of systems, to come under His,
yeah.
And it requires constant, fervent, aware activation, but it's because of that it builds momentum, like we've been saying, and that momentum continues to, that momentum allows you to carry it forward. And then a lifestyle like we have in the example of the Brewer family of mom and dad, where there's this example of a lifestyle that is just like rolling forward like a steam engine and it won't be stopped. Mm-hmm. And so I say that as a point of activation to even just add to what Gabe was saying with the little cards that we have, that if there's something on there that you're actively pressed in, think about it in terms of like every decision that you make that's our decision, but it's active. Builds and it goes and goes and goes and goes, and it continues to create momentum to carry forward. So just be thinking about that as a point of activation, okay?
Okay.
Yeah. All right, we good so far?
Yeah.
Yes.
Feel free to jump in at any point if you need to.
I don't know anything to add to that. No science. Yes.
All right. Cool. So just to highlight a couple things from the last portion, which was Numbers 20:14 through 22:1. Remember, the context of this is that they are in the latter, well, the final years of what the time of the wilderness was said to be, which was 40 years. There's a new generation that's risen up. The old generation has died off, has died in the desert. Dad highlighted that there was this time of the silent years. I was joking with Megan earlier. I feel like I wish this last week was like in, this last week for us felt like a, not worth mentioning, like just forget about that week. But there was this period of the silent years not worth mentioning because it was just mundane. It was, there was no movement. It was just repetitive and they just kept having to grind through stuff, right? Remember that there's a account coming out of Egypt. Mm-hmm. In my mind, I picture like this ragtag group of people that's just like freshly out of bondage and it's like, what the heck are we doing? Mm-hmm. And it's like, everybody, let's get a count, let's take inventory so we can move properly, right? So then there's this pre-count and then there's going to be a post-count. We're going to see that coming in the coming portions, but there's purpose in that. We all remember at the beginning of Numbers when we entered into this book that there's huge significance in a pre-count and a post-count, mm-hmm. that the number didn't change a whole lot, but who it was mattered, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And remember also that the point of that count was to really continue to evaluate the establishment of his new systems. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the first section of that portion, again, just to skim through it, because Dad covered it very well, and tons of activation and direction came from that, but the portion where it highlights Edom denying passage, obviously there's a historical connection to the bloodlines. Everybody remembers Edom was Esau. Yes. Saying that right. I always mix up the twins. Jacob and Esau. Esau was Edom, right? That was a different way. That was a different name for him. And so these Edomites, this tribal community, was part of that lineage, right? So there's obviously that historical connection there. Some commentary, just to throw this out there, draws parallels between Edom and Christianity. So you have like this group of Hebrews, or you have the Israelite nation requesting passage, requesting aid. And then you have this group of people that's just like in denial, like, no, you can't come through here. Whatever that is, right? So there's different things that you can evaluate in that. Dad highlighted that the significance in this is that you may have a shared bloodline, but a shared bloodline doesn't necessarily mean shared inheritance, nor does it have to mean shared intimacy.
Yeah.
That was a significant word, especially in light of the systems we're coming out of,
right.
The holidays we used to celebrate, this
yes.
time of year that we're in. Has anybody
yeah.
had in the last week confrontation from family? Or even like, maybe not confrontation, but it could have just been like stuff passing in the workplace or school friends or whatever.
Yeah.
Anybody been caught with like, somebody says, Merry Christmas, and you're like, ah, happy holidays. You too. It's all part of us working out of it, right? The next section, when Aaron was gathered to his people, Dad highlighted that this was a leader passing to make a way for a new type of leader, right? That this was not just a... It's funny because you'd think, like in our Western mindset, you'd think somebody as significant or as important as that, right? If you think of like the vice president dying, it wouldn't just be like a quick blurb in history and then we all have like 30 days as a nation and then forget about it, right?
Yeah.
There'd be national spectacles and there'd be memorials everywhere. And I mean, not that that's wrong, mm-hmm. but I find it interesting that there's not this highlight, there's not this extreme focus on death.
Yeah.
But rather it's the acknowledgement of a role fulfilled,
yeah.
like Dad was saying, right?
Yeah.
Not adding anything new, but it was the acknowledgement of a role fulfilled of one leader passing who represented a type of leadership in the wilderness
yep.
to make way for a new one.
Yep.
It was also significant that it was an ordained and purposeful change and that it wasn't just a figurative passing of the torch, but there was literally garments passed over.
Yeah.
There was significance in that, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't just like, well, I guess his son's going to step up now, but there was a very purposeful, direct passing of the garments and the significance that came with that role. That represented also a shift in the dynamic of the leadership, which represented a shift in the dynamic of the people. And it was a call to a higher level of maturity in the leadership, and a new type of leadership needed for a new phase in the wilderness, a new phase of entering the land promised to them, but also a level of maturity that the people needed to step in line with to match. For us, this is a call that we can't become conditioned to, like Dad said, right. Wilderness-style leadership.
Yes.
Which you highlighted it. It's been said a couple times, and hopefully we've been, since Hanukkah, hopefully we've been chewing on that. Because that is a, and it's funny because it's not a new word in the sense of, we know things like the rescue cycle. Mm-hmm. From death to life.
Yeah.
From orphan to son. We know all these things.
Yeah.
Right? We've heard them before, over and over and over and over. But it is absolutely powerful to have the portions giving like direct examples and equipping to fully activate what we felt Yahweh calling us to as a family to further walk out, right? Again, all things that Dad has said, I'm just repeating and reiterating what he said. This wilderness style leadership was often aimed at like fix it all, keeping people alive. It was aimed at, he mentioned three things: preservation, rescue, and survival.
Yeah.
The people were in such a state that in order to make it through for that duration of time, they had to have somebody that kept pulling them out.
Yeah.
Kept pulling them out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was a repetitive cycle that was based on that preservation, rescue, and survival need. He also in this section highlighted the characteristic of restraint. That as you grow in maturity, a major mark of maturity is being able to exercise restraint.
Yeah.
Remember he mentioned like you can't fully know how to restrain yourself unless you fully know violence, mm-hmm. right? It's like, I always share jujitsu analogies, but anybody who does jujitsu and has rolled with a fresh, ego-filled white belt who's brand new on the mats, who's trying to prove something, can't show restraint. They gas themselves out, they hurt people, they get crazy. But if you roll with a seasoned practitioner, like Jalen's a great example. I always tell Amber, he's like one of my favorite people to roll with. Because I know he could absolutely destroy me. Like leave me like a broken bag of bones on the mat. But he it's because of his awareness of violence that he can show an extreme level of restraint.
Yeah.
And it's because of that that he's one of the best training partners.
Hmm.
Another mark of maturity is the awareness of boundaries, right? One thing that Dad highlighted that was very, very key for us to remember is that he said that God's promises will often come with boundaries. Mm-hmm. We're coming out of a mindset and out of systems, right, where we may have once thought like, promises and freedoms it means just that. It's like full freedom. It's full access.
Yeah.
It's like never ending. But the reality is that just like a good parent will do, when you are fulfilling a promise or you're granting an extreme level of blessing, there's often a needed boundary with that so that it doesn't just go off the rails.
Right. Right?
And so a mark of maturity is awareness of those boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Again, I'm doing this armory style. Are we good on that? Any questions?
Yeah.
Any confusion on any of those things?
No.
Okay.
Good.
Awesome. So then, like I said, those sections that were highlighted absolutely were equipping. They launched us off on a pretty significant trajectory. For me, I think it corrected a major trajectory. The next section in that Torah portion specifically is I think I'm saying this right, but Nehushtan, which is the section of snake on a pole. Everybody read that last portion? Who got to that section and was like,
what
are we talking about? Okay, the reason I ask that is because something that I was thinking about this week in my own mindset, and if nobody else had this mindset, that's totally fine, but just to put it out there, at one point, like over the years, I think there was times where I would like, I like stories and I like I've always been interested, even when I was a kid, like of lineage and history and all those types of things. So sometimes I'd go back and I would just read sections of, I didn't know at the time it was the Torah, but I'd go back and I'd read sections of the Old Testament, right? And so I remember at one point I had seen this story and I had like skimmed through it. And I remember having the thought, like, what the heck is that? And in at the time and in the mindset that I was in, it made me question who he was and his character. Because in my immaturity, I would think like, okay, this good God put this idol up, right? So like it was twisted, it was weird, it didn't make sense, I didn't fully understand it, but it was just this section where it was just kind of like, I don't, okay, it's that's there, I don't, that's that, I don't really know what to do with it. But a couple things to get into with this is, it's a hugely significant piece. And I know that what I wanted to speak to in it is just high level, because I'll put this disclaimer out there. There's mysteries in this that I know I can't touch. And I know that mom and dad specifically would be able to like really dive deep into and bring some direction to the family. But I did want to just tackle a couple things on it, just to highlight some things that I think that are significant for us to understand in it. And see his character in it. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
Okay. So, first of all, in this section, it's funny because the actual section of the snake on a pole is just a few... You guys seen Mom's text on Kingdomers? She said, it's the gospel in a paragraph. And I was just going to say, this section on the snake is really just like a couple of verses. But it really is like there's such a profound depth to it that... if you just read it on surface level, you really will just think like, okay, well that's there, and miss the depth in it. But that section begins with it's kind of funny that this little piece is in here, but it begins with, so there's the title, Nehushtan, snake on a pole, but then this section actually begins with battle, right? Like the Israelites find themselves in battle again. And they're going through this process of like going through the territory, and God gives them, they ask permission to go to battle, and they say that we will they'll vow the ban of destruction, basically. Did anybody read that and wonder like what is a ban of destruction? This is a really interesting, sorry guys. Okay. It's a really interesting concept, and it makes sense. But it's almost like on the scale of things, it's kind of hard to wrap your mind out of, but I'll wrap your mind on, but I'll kind of just speak to what it is. But a ban of destruction basically is when they would dedicate completely something that they would conquer solely to him. And they would vow to not plunder, take treasures, take captive, whatever it was. It was just like, everything that's here is yours. And it was a condition on their part for Yahweh to give them basically the blessing, the anointing, whatever you call it, to successfully go through and conquer this thing that they're trying to conquer. So it was something dedicated to God, not to be kept for personal use. Something that's interesting is that the name of one of these places, Horma, it translates to destruction. Which it's kind of like the chicken or the egg thing. Did they name it? Was it named before? Was it named after because of what happened there? I think you could look at it both ways. But Horma means destruction. The ban of destruction also represented an act of obedience, not a military campaign. So it wasn't a selfish driven, I'm going to conquer this land because I need the land. But there was a God-ordained direction that he had the people on. Mm-hmm. And there was a need for his anointing and his provision, his power, his hand to guide them through that. So that happens, right? There's a ban of destruction. It's an act of obedience, not a military campaign, not selfish driven. But then I can only imagine at that point, like, and we've talked about this before, right? But like they should have known prior. We talk about before, you have to know the before the report, but they knew it was foretold that there would be giants in the land, right? There would be difficulty. There would be resistance, all those things. But I can only imagine at this point, they're so close. It's a new generation. They're so close. They're right there. And there's still these battles, even though they're anointed and they're pushing through, they're obviously blessed in what they're doing. God's obviously with them, but I can only imagine like the weariness that could probably settle in into their physical beings, right? So then you have the people as they continue moving. There's another example of more grumbling. Mm-hmm. not only is it grumbling, but something that is significant in this is that there's some commentary when you look at the translation of the actual scripture, that some of the grumbling or the complaining here, where they're saying, you know, why did you take us out of Egypt? We should have to just die here. We could have been there. All that stuff. I don't need to like say it word for word, but that level of accusation is what it was the same when you translate it as the accusation that came from Hasatan in the garden against Yahweh's character. Mm-hmm. When he accused him of having an ulterior motive, mm-hmm, and having like a hidden agenda. So this isn't just like, I'm tired and I'm complaining. But this is like a generation of people that now is complaining and accusing to the degree that they're saying, there's something you're hiding and I'm tired of it.
Yeah.
Or there's something you're not telling me, and is mom like texting on this one? I want to know what she's saying. I need you here, mom. She should just get on the box and just like butt in. Just take yourself off me.
Just butt in.
Does that make sense though? Like that level of complaining, it was to the level of accusation.
Yeah.
That it was far beyond just, like, I'm tired, this is hard, this sucks, but it was like, there's something you're not telling me, and I want to know what it is. Mm-hmm. And so it was because of that the consequence of that disobedience, of that accusation, there was a severe punishment that matched. Mm-hmm. And that's when you see the serpents released. Mm-hmm. So he's accused of having a hidden agenda, serpents are released. One thing in another commentary that I found that also talked about different translations, or when you, not different translations, but when you compare the translations, is that they actually use the word loathe. They loathe, not just like, I'm tired of the manna, I'm tired of the provisions you give me, but they loathe to the point that they actually could, when you look at the formation of those words, it actually could form, the consonants could form the same word as thorn, which would be like thorn in your side.
Yeah.
So imagine that twisted mindset to get to the point where you're not only accusing his character of an ulterior motive, but so much so that you're taking the direct provision that he's given you to sustain you to that point, and saying that now is a thorn in my side.
Yeah.
You just destroyed your dirt.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, could you, for any parents, can you imagine, like, I don't know if your kids have done this. I can't think of like a literal example, but like, I don't know, maybe I can. Maybe it's like lunchtime or something. Like, you give your kid a plate of food, and it's like, here's the sustenance I give you, so you can continue life. And it's like, that's a thorn in my side. Not that I can't imagine my kids saying that.
Yeah.
But
I don't want that.
Yeah, I don't want that. That's gross. Or it makes me sick.
Oh my God.
It's making me choke. Chew your food, kid.
Chew it.
Anyway, so think about the. It's easy also to just compartmentalize and categorize, like, man, those Israelites. I'm like disturbed thinking about what. This made me run through like so many questions in my mind. What do I view in my life?
Yeah.
That is direct blessing and provision from him for me to continue.
Yep.
And I'm like, man, that thing just sucks.
Yep, that's really good.
And that's that thorn in my side, that thing is so, it causes me so much pain.
Yeah.
I mean, you could take it to so many literal examples, like your job. I hate my job.
Yeah.
I've said that so many times, right? I hate this. This is so dumb. Man, my boss sucks. I've never said that. But, right, so you can think of literal examples like that. But what other things that are, like, more maybe internal, spiritual? Yes. They may not be, like, a direct complaint that you have.
Yeah.
But it's something that's deep in there that is like that thorn in my side.
Yes.
That thing that is just irking me and like causing me so much pain and discomfort all the time. Yet he's looking at you like, I don't even know what.
Yeah, don't. That's really good.
I would not be a good guy. There would be so much profanity. All right. So, the cool thing in this, the cool thing, this generation, there was a significant moment that happened. Because although this was happening, and there was this severe consequence to the severe offense, right? There was a significant moment in that these people were, for the first time, because all the previous generations hadn't been able to do this, they had to receive it from their leadership or be corrected from their leadership, but this generation repented on their own. And they stepped up and said, we screwed up, we need to repent for this, this is because of what we did. And then that triggered what ended up being Yahweh's instruction to Moshe to put the serpent on the pole and erect that structure. So that was a significant moment. The question that we want to ask in that is, could we be a people to mature to the point where we're not only repeating the old generation's issues, but surpassing the example we see here to where there's not even an accusation, there's not even a grumble, there's not even a complaint, and we're so far beyond that that it's just yes, Dad, and move.
Yes.
Right?
Amen.
That's what we're on our way to. Yep. Now, there's some interesting things in this because it says in the scripture, simply looking at the bronze snake would bring life. So again, come out of like an old framework or an old mindset where it's like, okay, I'm just going to look at this thing and it makes me better. The point was that it was simple obedience. It wasn't overcomplicated, which obviously is God's grace in all this, right? He doesn't demand that we jump through a million hoops and do all these crazy things. It's simple obedience. And he's not overcomplicated.
Yeah.
It was death. So it was the acknowledgement that death by way of sin is conquered by death, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
It was a foreshadowing of Yeshua's sacrifice on the cross. And just like the serpent on the pole, you guys could note this, that in John 3, chapter 3, verse 14 through 15, so John 3, 14 through 15, Yeshua actually himself references this event. And so the purpose of this was to look through the serpent to heaven. Just like we're to look through the cross or go through the cross to Yahweh's intent on the other side, right? Not go around it, not jump through different hoops, simple obedience, but there's a purpose in what you do through it.
Yeah.
There's a warning in this. Because eventually, if you reference 2 Kings chapter 18, we don't have to go there, but 2 Kings chapter 18, the serpent, over the years, shifted from a God-ordained instrument to the object of idol worship. And in 2 Kings 18, you actually see one of the righteous kings, King Hezekiah, had to step up and tear down the idol. So that was a significant event. Just like it's been said before, and this was at the time, I think we had to chew on this a little bit. I think now we're at a level of maturity where this is like, I think actively in our minds. But it's been said before that we can idolize the Son, we can idolize Yeshua, and dismiss the Father's instructions instead of seeing him as that doorway to go through to the fullness of his instructions. Mm-hmm. So too can we idolize him and miss what's on the other side of that, right?
Yeah.
A level of maturity is required in this to not become stagnant in God's very intervention. So a question in this is, how do we in our own lives take something that's given by God and turn it into an idol?
Yeah.
Something that is a strategy he gives us, a direction he gives us, a tool he gives us, even people that he gives us. And it's like, it's God ordained in a moment, we use it. But then how often can we let that thing just go year after year after year after year? Meanwhile, he's calling us to different levels of maturity, higher levels of maturity, and we can just leave that thing as it is, and that becomes our idol. Mm-hmm. Instead of God's continued direction, it's like he's over here giving direction, and we're like, but this thing that I followed before, this thing that I used to do.
Yeah.
So be thinking about that in terms of activation as well. All right. I'm going to run through this probably a lot quicker, but continuing into the next section of the defeat of Sion and Og. So the people then, from that moment, they keep moving through the wilderness. They encounter Sion of the Amorites. You guys remember that there's historical context to this, right? You know, God said that they would encounter these people and that they would take over this land. So the interesting thing here is that the Amorites, they confront Israel instead of the other way around. Sion, the name itself, means to sweep away or overthrow, which in the context means that symbolized the king himself, that symbolized the king's strength and prowess, that he would sweep away, that he would overthrow, he would conquer all those things. But look at how this got reversed when he opposed God's people, which was the ultimate representation of God's ordained plan over the course of generations to see them through to something. And when they walked in alignment with that and they moved forward and there was opposition to that, how that got flipped, right? So instead of him sweeping away the people and him overthrowing the nation of Israel, that he himself was swept away, overthrown, conquered, all those things. So it was the example of military might versus God's plan and God's ordained movement. And so thinking about in our own lives, what can we evaluate in that context where there's a God-ordained plan and there's a direction he has you in, but there's a man-powered or a thing that you're trying to do from the outside to come against that, and how that can be reversed, how that can be flipped. Right? Mm-hmm. Then the people encounter Og of Bashan. These were an intimidating people, but God is what I had here. The cool thing is that when we talk about like the before report and all those things, we knew that there would be giants. I read somewhere that Og actually means giant or powerful. And somewhere I read that he was one of the remaining people of the Rephaim, which were giants. So literally it was like a giant intimidating people. And that was said, I think in Deuteronomy 3:10 is where that verse is, where it references the Rephaim. So again, we see, despite all those challenges and all those things, when they were in proper alignment, the land was ordained for Israel, the promise was right there, they had to know his promises, and they kept moving through it, right? Okay. We kind of skimmed through that. Okay. Again, kind of a checkpoint. Are we all good so far?
Yeah. Yes.
Good?
Good.
Okay.
Are we awake?
Yes.
Bring me a water bottle.
So, sorry, I'm kind of taking more of like a teaching approach.
You're good.
Jay,
good.
When you were saying that level, are you saying that every time they grumbled or complained, it was at that same degree as Satan in the garden accusing?
What I read was that this one specifically, the severity of it.
How did you see that?
So I don't have the knowledge myself to like go that deep, but it was from pulling on different commentary, and I could share that with you. But different commentary was just highlighting that if you take the translations of those words, that it's the same in Genesis, where it's like the accusation. So it's the same translations in that sense. That was a good question though. Okay. So, now, this week's portion, which is numbers 22:2-40. I'm going to throw out another disclaimer. In this one, there's so many deep things. There's so much depth in this. And without mom and dad, I can't possibly, like, not even in my own research abilities or whatever, I can't possibly go as deep as they could go. Mm-hmm. So, I know that there's probably going to be things maybe when they're away they'll get on Vox or something like that. I hope they do. I'm sure they're listening. But I know that there's going to be incredible depth that they'll get into with this. So just throwing that out there. To start this portion, I also wanted to just say that as a warning, and this came from like I had to do this to myself first. I'm not projecting this.
Yeah.
To myself first, I had to make sure before I read I read all the way through it, and I had to make sure that I captured this. So as a warning, be careful who you identify with in this portion.
That's good. Yeah.
Okay. So there's obviously a lot of key players in this portion. Mm-hmm. And it is so easy to...
And you're not Moshe, still.
Right.
Well, not only that.
You're not Israelite.
Still, you're not Moshe.
Anyway.
You're not the donkey.
Yeah.
You are not the...
I'm the donkey.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so be careful who you identify with in this portion.
That's rude.
All right. So, another just contextual thing throughout there. What?
Nothing.
This is just the beginning of a multi-chapter story.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't possibly get into all the things that are to be unlocked in this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because this story of Balak and Balaam is one that spans, I think, three or four chapters. So this is just the beginning section of that. So keep that in mind as we go into it, that this will be another literal point of activation for us to practice building precept upon precept and taking what can happen tonight and being able to activate that now, carry it forwards, so that we have a place for the next revelation to land.
Okay? Yes.
All right. So we see these characters come into play, Balak and Balaam. And a interesting thing to note right off the bat is that there's a different strategy. Because these are all these players in these stories are kings, right? You have Sion and Og, and then you have Balak. If at any point I say the names backwards, you guys are going to have to correct me. I've read through this so many times, I feel like I'm still mixing the names back and forth. But King Balak took a different approach than the previous kings. So he's watching, right? I can only imagine. There's no internet at the time. There's no, like...
Tweet.
Right, there's no tweeting Snapchat. Happening. There's no Facebook posts, whatever. Yeah. So stuff had to move by word of mouth and messengers and runners that had to go all over the place, right? So...
They're coming.
So I can only imagine this out-of-breath runner, this messenger who's, like, coming to me as King Balak and telling me, like, you have no idea what's coming. And the force and the size of this multitude that's coming, and they've defeated this king and that king, and they've gone through this place and that place, and they've done this and that. And I can only imagine, like, what that would do to, like, the heart of man, right? But there's a different strategy we see here between Balak and the previous kings. Instead of taking a military approach right off the bat and saying, I'm going to stand on the border and just oppose them right away, and just start attacking them right away. He takes a different approach and wants to go more of a spiritual route. So just keep that as a context. Something else to highlight in the beginning of this is when we talk about Moab, does that name ring a bell? I've heard that name before, right? Moab. When did we hear that before? Does everybody remember, like, the significant place where that started? Where the Moabites started.
That was Lot's daughters.
Yep. So going back to Genesis 19, verse 30 is this section where once they've escaped Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot was interceded on behalf of, and he and his daughters escaped, and they hid in the caves. They were saved, right?
Right, get out.
Somebody.
That's what we were hearing.
So him and his daughters are—they're rescued, right? They're interceded on behalf of. They get out of this place. Now, where the Moabites started, again referencing this section of Genesis 19, verse 30, is I think it was the older daughter. They got I don't have to go into detail, but they got their father Lot. Drunk, they slept with him, and they both bore children. And they named that son Moab. And it says in the scripture that he fathered, and he's the father of the Moabites to this day. Which brings us then to this day, which means in this context right here, where we're seeing, again, revisiting the Moabites. Now, Moab itself, the nation of the Moabite people, had a really complex relationship with Israel, because they shared a lineage, literally a blood relative lineage, which connected them to the promise. Because you see Lot shot off this way, and Abraham shot off this way, and Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the nation of Israel, all these things. So we're in this place today where you have these two people groups, right? So it's a complex relationship because they're, in a way, connected to the promise. But you see that the lineage matters. The bloodline matters. And what you do with that promise also matters. So because of its rough beginnings and its continued corruption, it's a complex relationship where it's like adversarial. Eventually, there's foretelling of Moab's restoration in prophecies that are in Jeremiah and its connection to Israel. There's also this weird relationship. There's this weird dynamic that happens because the lineage of Moab, I found this, I'll have to maybe share it with you guys, but I found this really cool image that just showed like the breakdown, really high level obviously, but the breakdown of the lineage from Abraham and Lot down to where we see, this is foreshadowing obviously, but the lineage of Moab eventually leads to Ruth and her marriage to the kinsman redeemer, which is the rejoining of the two bloodlines, which Ruth then became the great-grandmother of King David. And then King David, obviously, there was so many generations thereafter that led to Yeshua. So it's a crazy complex relationship because there was this connection to the promise, but obviously a majorly off trajectory,
yeah.
Right? And what they did with the promise was not right. But then you still see Yahweh's intention and his absolutely beautiful character to still bring redemption to something as severe as what you see here. So there's this interesting, complex relationship. If you reference Matthew chapter 1, like the very first chapter actually details name by name the lineage from there leading to Yeshua. Which I encourage you guys to go read that, because if you think about the context of it all, it's really powerful to actually read through all the names. It's pretty impressive. So why is this important? Like I said, despite the story, God's plans and intentions prevail. Mm-hmm. The question I had in this is, why wouldn't you want to be aligned?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's good.
Like, why wouldn't you want to be aligned? Like, we see time after time his absolute redemptive power.
Yeah.
And all of these things that are at play, why would we not want to be snapped into alignment?
Right.
Which includes every ordained window of time that we have, every moment that we have to be together, to receive correction from him, to receive a shift, to trajectory change, whatever it is, that brings us back into alignment. Why would we not want to continue in that? Mm-hmm. Obviously, that question itself demands a level of wrestling and work on our part. But that's a big question to wrestle through. Good. All right. So I broke this down a little bit into a few sections. So I'll just kind of go through a few things. So in the story itself, the first section I had was verse 2-4. You guys, and you don't have to like notate it this way, but it's just kind of how I broke it up to understand it for me to be able to at least speak to it. But in verse 2-4. We see that Balak was very much governed by fear. Mm-hmm. He was a perfect example of being completely self-motivated, self-interested, driven by fear, mm-hmm. governed by fear. Remember last week, it was highlighted again in Dad's teaching, we're called to govern fear.
Yes.
So he, being governed by fear, was anticipating the worst. Mm-hmm. He was just assuming
he knew he was incapable.
He knew he was incapable.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing interesting to note here is the elders of Midian. We've heard before, obviously, like the Midianites, that had a different context at one point. Remember, Midian was a group of people that was very much in favor of the Israelites as they were coming out of Egypt, their relationship with Moshe, right? So one thing, just to maybe clear up confusion, because I had to read this a few times, but then we see here like the elders of Midian are now partnered with Moab against Israel. So if there's any confusion there, the thing that I found in this is that they were a nomadic people that traveled a lot. And so dynamics and relationships and ties they had probably changed a lot. So maybe just something to throw out there that, so that there's not like confusion there. If there's something deeper in that, I'm sure that there's something that we could go back to. Anyway, so some things to note there. And then the next section I had was verse 5 through 7. And in here, we see Balak knew of the reputation of Balaam. Balaam, this soothsayer, this sorcerer, whatever title he had, was a pretty well-known guy in the region. He wasn't just a nobody that kind of showed up on his own. He was sought after. So Balak knew of him, and he sought after him. And he was so serious that he sent people to go retrieve him and bring him to where he needed to be, right? Another significant thing to note in that is that culturally or like historically, I read that in order for a sorcerer to like cast a curse or like cast something, they had to see that person. We had to see that thing. You had to be in eyesight of it. So he literally, in order to do what he had to do, he had to go. He couldn't just say it from where he was. You couldn't just send a message and say, like, well, say it where you're at and we'll see if it works. He had to travel to King David. It's the funny thing in this too is that that both those people, they knew Israel, like they knew probably like who they were, some reputation, there's some things that they had done, but they didn't know enough. Because if they had known enough, at least I would think, if they had known enough, they probably would have submitted to God's plan. However, because they didn't know enough, they knew of them, but they didn't know the details of God ordained's plan and all the things that he was doing, that there was, we have this story, obviously. The next section, verse 8 through 14. Something significant to note here is that another thing that was common to sorcery at the time that I was looking at was that it was common for them to hear at night, to get their sorceries at night. It also came in the form of dreams. Like that was a common thing, which to me felt significant in the sense of like it's done in hiding, it's done in secret, it's done in like a undercover way, it can be done in darkness. It's not a prophetic act of God that's like not boastful. You know what I'm saying? Yes. Right? It's not that it's boastful, but it's like it's open. It's because it's founded with absolute truth. There's no hidden agenda in it. There's no room for accusation. It's like, this is my prophecy and this is what I'm going to do. And it goes through every time. Mm-hmm. Whereas this was you see over and over the pattern in this story is Balaam says, all right, well, you stay the night. Let me go figure it out and I'll come back to you. So there's this loophole or there's this, for me, the question personally was like, am I ever operating in secrecy? Am I ever operating in a way of like, let me go see what God says and I'll come back to you. Let me take what you suggest and let me go pray about it. Mm-hmm. Not that we can't seek his counsel, right? Like don't twist that, but hear it in the sense of can we be aware of and not step into secrecy and hiding? And it's just me and him, and he's just going to tell me, and I don't have to tell anybody else. Right. So be on the lookout for those types of loopholes.
That's good.
Another thing here, Balaam, if anybody read this and was a little bit confused, he heard from God. He heard Adonai. He references directly his name. But the thing to note here is that he knew of God, but not how he was. He knew who he was, but not how he was. He knew that he was a god and probably in his mind a jumble of other nations' gods that he at some point would have to negotiate with different ones for different reasons at different times. But he didn't acknowledge and know that he was the only and the highest, right? Yeah. So We have to, this just reaffirms that if we live in a lifestyle and we continue to go down a path of stopping at knowing of him,
right,
but not fully walking through and walking out how he is, how quickly we can still be spiritual,
yes,
and still not have anything to
yes.
do with him.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
That's good.
Something to note here is that in this story, a huge piece to pay attention to is that God will use what he needs to accomplish his divine will.
Right.
So there could be room in maybe different people's minds for accusation of like, why would God use this guy? Like this sorcerer or this whatever it is. But God will still use the means that he needs to.
Yeah.
In order to accomplish it, right? And there's always going to be a lesson or a teaching or something significant that he'll do in that. So something, a pattern to look for in this is at first, Balaam obeys, right? The people come to retrieve him and he says, no, I can't do it. And God affirms it. He said, let me see what God says. God says, don't go. So he tells the people, I can't go. So they leave. So at first he obeys, right?
Right.
Now, some commentary out there says that those messengers, well, not maybe not the messengers directly, but King Balak, obviously, he took it as like a form of negotiation. He was thinking Balaam was negotiating with him. Like, nah, I can't do it. Nah. But then it was like, all right, well, let me up the ante and let me add more to it. So he obeyed at first. They left. Now, the next section I broke into was verse 15 through 21. And now we see that there's much more weight behind the persuasion now, right?
Yeah.
He not only just sends like messengers to retrieve Balak or Balaam, but King Balak sends high-ranking dignitaries, people with great importance, people he trusted,
yeah,
people who could represent the symbol of wealth.
Yeah.
They could really persuade and negotiate. What I took from this is that there really was here a testing of Balaam's heart. We'll see as the story goes on how this plays out, but there was a testing of Balaam's heart. I kind of was like chuckling at this section because you see Balaam, again, he's like, all right, let me step into secret at night, see what Adonai says, and I'll let you know what he says in the morning. I was chuckling at it because I was thinking like I was picturing him like that he's being persuaded, these dignitaries are trying to get him to go, and he's like, oh, come on guys, I can't do it. And he goes, but, and then obviously he ends up going, right?
Yeah.
So he says here a key word that I found really interesting here is he says, well, the way I phrased it was Balaam was basically saying, when he went back that night with those high-ranking dignitaries to seek Adonai's word again and report back in the morning, what I took from that is he said, let me see what God might say to me. Which I was taking as, when I'm, whether I'm receiving correction or direction or a word or a teaching, whatever it is, if I'm having to wrestle through it, what loophole can I find myself in where I'm thinking, well, let me see what God might say about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which ultimately is, let me see what I'll say about that.
Right. Right.
Let me filter through that a little bit, and I'll let you know if I'm going to do it or not.
Yeah.
So another loophole or thing to be aware of in there. A funny thing here that people will like want to poke at with God's character that to untwist is God didn't like, he didn't change his mind and go, All right, Balaam, go ahead and go. He didn't change his mind because of Balaam's influence and because God's wishy-washy and because he was back and forth. Sometimes as a parent, have you ever caught yourself like you give a direction,
yes,
a couple moments go by and a circumstance changes,
yes,
and then your direction changes,
yes,
and you catch yourself after and you go, oh my gosh, I was I confused that whole thing. I don't know how many times I've done that and had to have like corrected it. I had to correct it after But then I might, as a parent, just as a side note, I might then like get mad at my kid for not responding, right? But it's like I was the one that caused confusion, right? So that's like a picture of a bad parent.
Yeah.
God here is not a bad parent. He didn't change his mind and get wishy-washy with it.
Right.
What I took from this was that he really was allowing a testing of Balaam's heart, and he was allowing Balaam's free will to act itself out. Mm-hmm. It's been highlighted and it's been said before that because of the nature of how God created us and our role in partnering with him, that we have free will.
Yep.
And that in that, we can take his direction or not.
Yep.
We can impart and we can dismiss a piece.
Yep.
We can do this, we can do that.
Yep.
And it's because of that, well, despite that, he will still walk out his plan.
Yep.
He will still carry out his ordained
his
ordained plans. But our free will is the variable in that.
Mm-hmm.
He's not wishy-washy. He's not back and forth.
Yes.
He doesn't change.
Mm-hmm.
It's us that has the pendulum all over the place. Yep. He's steadfast. He's steady. So God didn't change his mind here because he was wishy-washy. But it was Balaam's free will at play that Yahweh allowed him to walk out. So the funny thing is that as it goes on and as Balaam eventually meets Balak, what I noted here is that there was desperation on both sides of the story. You had King Balak, who was desperate, he was scared, he was anticipating the worst, and you have Balaam, who is also desperate for different reasons, right? So they're like these two points of desperation are coming to a convergence. A thing I noted here was that alignment to God's will versus going outside of that prevents desperation.
Yeah, that's good.
When we're in line with him, his instructions, when we're aligned with his will, and when we're walking that out, a way that you can test that is whether or not you find yourself in that system.
Mm-hmm.
You're desperate. You're anticipating the worst. You're speaking everything about myself right now, but you're thinking about the worst outcome. You're thinking about all the things that are unseen that you're wondering are going to be seen.
Yeah.
But his promises, his will, his alignment prevents desperation. Remember that also in the context of grumbling, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same kind of thing. The people, when they grumbled, were probably desperate in different ways that you could look at. Okay. So then, eventually, from there, Balaam picks up. He goes with those dignitaries. So the next section I broke into was 22 through 31. I just had a little random note in here. In my mind, I was thinking, like, it kind of reminds me of Pharaoh and his heart being hardened over time, and it just kept going. Balaam's free will and his push for ultimately for what ultimately was just selfish gain and selfish ambition, just pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. So we have him riding his donkey. The donkey sees the angel of Adonai, and the donkey runs off the path, beats the donkey. Gets back on the path, continues forward. And the donkey smashed him against the wall. And he crushed his foot. So he's not only, he's with these dignitaries, right? He's traveling with this group of people. These high-ranking officials who retrieved him from the king himself.
He's like losing it in the back.
All over the place like that. So donkey runs off the path, beats the donkey, probably out of sheer embarrassment.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
This thing was being like a real ass, right? Gets back on the path, continues moving. Then he crushes his foot, so he's embarrassed. Now he's in pain.
And he doesn't know more.
Continues moving. And then he's on a narrow path. I didn't think about that. There could be a word in that. Then he's on a narrow path. And the angel of Adonai scares the donkey again. And the donkey has nowhere to go, nowhere to run, doesn't crush him again, so it just drops between his legs. So now he's like, what the F are we doing? And this whole time, you're laughing at it, he's just blind.
Mm-hmm.
So this spiritual dude who's highly sought after, who's well known in the region for his sorcery abilities, is blind. Even in the face of divine intervention.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Literally, the angel of Adonai in front of him, and his donkey can see it, and he's blind to it. I think that he was blind, and he had a major filter over his eyes,
yeah,
probably because of just sheer ambition.
Yeah.
Selfish ambition for the gain, the notoriety, the riches. I can only imagine if he was that sought after, his
yeah
ego, mm-hmm, the things that he wanted to,
yep,
to build upon.
Yeah.
And he was just blind to it. A question I had on this is, the donkey obviously is not just an animal. At that time, it represented a vehicle. Right?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have a car. He didn't have a scooter.
Yeah.
A scooter.
A moped.
That's probably what it would be. He'd be scooting on a moped. But what vehicle of our own will do we beat into our own submission?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning in our own walk, in our own lives, what vehicle, maybe it was even a God-ordained vehicle at one point, do we, for our own direction, our own ambition, do we beat back into place,
yeah,
despite divine intervention,
yeah,
God's direction,
yeah,
maybe even other people in our lives that step up and say, hey,
yeah,
mm-hmm,
that's not the right thing to do.
Yeah.
It could be relationship here. It's discipleship I get from Megan. It's something that mom and dad correct me in. It's whatever it is, right? It's the family Yahweh afforded us. What vehicle do we have that we will beat into submission to maintain the direction that we want?
Right. Mm, that's good.
In spite of intervention.
Yep.
Now, in all of that, obviously, as we see in the story, he still was allowed to go.
Well, and hold on.
Go
obviously
ahead.
Hear that through the lens of what mom was speaking to with the rock.
Mm-hmm.
And beating the rock or beating Yeshua in order to produce something.
Yeah.
So then what happens if he's not producing, and then we try to take it into our own hands of, I'm going to then try to feed something into producing something for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, like if we're the tabernacle and he's got us on a trajectory, or he's saying, I need you to walk this way, and we will go off course, smash our feet into something, have our legs buckle beneath us, and we still won't submit to what he's saying. We need to walk out for our own tabernacle, for our own good.
Yeah.
And we'll let our entire bodies crumble.
Yeah.
Before we will submit to a direction that he has.
Yep.
Because we're blind by our own desire.
Yep. It's good. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
No, that was good. Yeah, it makes me think, too, of, like, the picture of this story is not to be confused with when he gives you a direction, like the nation of Israel had towards the promised land, and he told them there's going to be giants, there's going to be things you're going to encounter. That is different
right
than our own ambition
yes
driving forward
mm-hmm
against his
yes
direction.
Yep.
Right.
For our own gain.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The key.
The boundaries.
Yes, discern the boundaries. The key in that, just in like simple terms, I'm sure we could go quite a bit deeper for probably years, but the difference in that is submission, alignment, and I just had a word on the tip of my tongue and I just left my brain.
Is that something
more? Yeah.
You're alive.
Well, yeah, I mean, life versus death. Like, if you're grinding against something that's just, like, producing and manifesting more death and all those things versus something that you know is producing life.
Yeah.
Right? There's different ways that you can test that.
Yeah.
And so, although it may, in certain situations, it may even look the same, you're grinding and you're pushing up against something that's pushing back on you. This has been taught before. What was the word about being able to like equally push back against the word. Remember that?
Yeah.
It was that.
Like,
yeah, right. So it wasn't that we push against it and that we're trying to get away from it,
yeah,
or that we're trying to put it down or whatever that is, but that we can be equally
yes.
pressing against the word.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Anyway, we could go way deeper now, but. All right. So next section I had was verse 32 through 35. In this section, we see, so Balaam is, he's called out directly. At this point, there's no, like, he's stopped in his tracks. The last thing that is on the list is just killing him right there. So he's called out directly. Now he can see. Now he sees the angel that night. And a thing I noted in this is not that this dynamic wasn't present the whole time, but now that he sees, there's this seriousness of life and death. Because the angel makes it very clear, I could just kill you now.
Yeah.
Right. So now there's this seriousness of life and death. Balaam then repents. But what I want us to gather in this is to pay attention, and I think I'm probably just going to read it real quick, but pay attention to the language he uses when he repents here. Because number one, it reminded me of myself. But it was not really a real repentance. Mm-hmm. And a turning away from, right? Repentance is you acknowledge, you turn away.
Yeah.
You change.
Yeah.
Okay, let me just read it real quick. Balaam said to the angel that night, I have sinned, for I did not know that you were standing in the road to oppose me. Okay, he dismisses himself. I didn't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All these corrections came. I didn't know.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I don't know how many times I said that as a kid, and kids said that this week. I didn't know. Okay. I've sinned. I did not know you were standing in the road to oppose me. Now, if this is displeasing in your eyes, I'll go home. He's still pushing it.
Yeah.
If this is a bad idea, then I'll go home. Instead of repent, turn away.
Yeah.
In his case, literally, repent, go home. So pay attention to that repentance.
Yeah.
Because that is something that can either be a powerful reminder or a framework that we continue to operate in.
Yes. Yeah.
Yep.
Which we don't want, right? Yeah, we don't want to continue to operate in that mindset of, I didn't know,
right.
Which is different than literally, I don't know. Which provides us the window of opportunity to receive what he brings us, which is truth.
Yeah.
Yes.
So then we do know.
Yep.
Right? We say it all the time. Once we've heard this. There's no going back.
Yeah.
You heard it, move in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's different than I don't know.
Yeah.
There's two different I don't knows at play.
Right.
One's for selfish self-preservation. One is a genuine, humble place of I didn't know. Mm-hmm. Now I know.
Yes.
The next section of if this is displeasing in your eyes, so he's still testing it. Mm-hmm. How many times can we do that to Yahweh's direction? Another point of discipleship, correction in my life. Somebody's bringing me correction. She's bringing up something in me that is clearly I'm doing that's out of alignment. And it's like, well, if this, then I'll change. Or if it's really that bad, I'll address it. Or if this, whatever, right?
If it gets to this point, then maybe.
Yeah, if it get, we negotiate, right? Second. It's all the ifs. So again, seeing that this could either be a clear, like red flag or thing that we can look at as a pattern, or it can become a framework that we continue to operate. Mm-hmm. So after this repentance, we see again that the angel of Adonai said to Balaam, go with the men, but speak only the word that I tell you. So Balaam went with Balak's princes. So again, because of your free will, go ahead and go. Despite the intervention, despite the pain, despite the embarrassment. I think, and I heard this in some commentary, but I think that's something that's really significant in this story as well, in this journey that he's taking to get to the king, is that by this point, he's broken down. He's embarrassed. He can't control his own donkey. He's in front of all these dignitaries who are taking him to this king that's calling him out, that's needing his help. It's thrown right in his face. I can't see spiritually unless it shows itself to me. And my donkey saw it. My damn donkey had to tell me. Right? At this point, I think that it's like ego crushed,
yeah,
totally embarrassed, and all these things, like Yahweh ordained that.
Yeah.
He's letting him, like, okay, you're gonna keep moving in your free will. All right, go for it.
Yeah.
And let's see how we deal with this. So now he's humiliated, and not only alone, but in front of others. So now verse 36 through the end, which is 41. He's desperate and humiliated, and he meets the king, who's also desperate and about to be humiliated. At this point, because of all of the free will that he's exercised and everything that's happened, there's no going back now, right? Think about, he's not only now in front of the king, he's at his destination, he's now got a job to do, he's humiliated, he's embarrassed, but he's still exercising his free will. And at this point, he's probably thinking, like, oh my gosh, this better work. Like, he's probably nervous, he's probably freaked out, right? So then he's gotta make it happen. So he's gotta do something. There's no going back now. The interesting thing here is that I think that I said it a couple ways, but the two play off of each other. And so I think that, like, the pattern that we can draw from this is that, like I said, there's desperate and humiliated meets desperate and about to be humiliated. So I think of that in a personal context of not only, like, spiritually, what can I draw from that? So what can I be aware of or deal with that is desperate in me, that's grabbing onto something else that's desperate, mm-hmm, for that thing that's also in me?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I'm just feeding back and forth,
yes,
back and forth, back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
All while God's like, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So there's a pattern that we can see. That's why I said in the very beginning, be careful who you identify in this, because I think that we could easily throw ourselves into, we're just the camp of Israel that's way over here.
Yeah.
And there's these evil things that are going on over here.
Yeah.
But we have to be able to identify with every piece of it, right? What things of Balaam am I?
Yes.
What pattern can I draw in my own,
yeah,
life in that? Same thing with Balak. Same thing with whatever it is. So the crazy thing in this is that those two are playing off of each other, and we see that once they meet, they immediately start stepping into action, right? He starts jumping into sacrifices. He starts, I can't remember the animals that are listed, but it sounds reminiscent of what his people, what God's people were divinely instructed to do, right? But it's all imitation. It's all, even down to, like, numbers being significant. It's groups of seven. It's taking something that is God ordained, God instructed, and significant in the kingdom, and it's this imitated twisting of it, which is just like Hasatan. He can't create, he just imitates.
Yep.
He doesn't do new things. Mm-hmm. It's just going to twist what we already know.
Yeah.
It's the accusation that comes in, right? Also, something to note is that he went to a high place. So again, we just see these, like, patterns of imitation. So the thing that I was drawing from this for us to be aware of in our own selves is, what forms of imitation do we operate in without fully coming under what he actually is instructing to do? So that literally could be in... It could be in everything. It could be in Shabbat. It could be in his literal instructions. It could be in the way that we interact with family.
Mm-hmm.
What are we imitating that's not genuine, right? Not ordained, not from him? It's all imitations. And ultimately, all of these imitations, again, are governed by fear, driven by selfish intent, and reaffirmed by those in the same mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So again, that can be a personal thing, that's a cycle and that's a system that's just running rampant in me, and that can also be an external thing where I'm latching onto other things, other systems, other groups of people, whatever it is, that's just keeping me and reaffirming those things, keeping me in that cycle. So there there really is a lot to draw from this portion. And like I said, a lot of it, I broke it into sections and I really kept it high level because I think that there's an incredible depth that is going to be continued to be tapped into as the story continues because it's a multi-chapter story. I wanted to be able to hit on some of those things, the free will aspect, the feeding off of aspect, the imitation, the way that we can identify whether we're operating out of desperation and we're driving hard forward in our own free will that is backed by selfish ambition, and we're completely outside of what he's trying to do that's been ordained, right?
Yeah.
So I think that there's a lot of, like I said, depth in this, but there's also a lot of simplicity in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like this portion can vary because of the nature of the story itself. I think it's very easily read as a story and sort of like put off to the side or like put on a shelf of like, wow, that was a crazy story. I'm like, man, God really did love his people because all this happened and, you know, nothing came of it. But there really is very profound patterns and things that we can identify and take from this to activate in our own moment by moment, day by day, walk forward. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yep. That's good.
So he definitely took more of a line for line. I did more of like a overall, like what was being hit on. And I, what I think is interesting is if you read Leviticus 26:29, it says, "Yet if you still will not listen and walk contrary to me," and I'm skipping a couple things, but you will eat the flesh of your sons and your daughters.
Mm-hmm.
I will destroy your high places and cut down your altars of incense. I will draw out a sword against you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just like, there's so many things even in that just parallel to even just this story. And sorry, you guys. It just, when we were reading the Torah portion, it just really stood out to me. Mom's Torah portion from 2 weeks ago. Something that she said is that the very thing that's dead is actually feeding you to live dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you guys can hear it, but between Leviticus 26 and between that, I don't know if you guys are hearing it, but it's cannibalism.
Mm-hmm.
The very thing that's dead is actually feeding you to live dead.
Mm-hmm.
So with this, I'm wanting to bring kind of like a sobering picture to where we are in that, and it's definitely a turn from like the lighter heart side of things, but to recognize where we are as a people and what he's pulling us out of. So if we're recognizing that exercising free will outside of him is an aspect of like where we're supposed to be, is that we are supposed to be fully like in our free will, but choosing to be connected to him, choosing to be the one that says, I will be next to you, even though I have all of this freedom that I can operate in. I want to be the one that is close to you, that will operate underneath you. In all of the gifts that you've given me in free will, I will be submitted.
Mm-hmm.
But where we are is recognizing that our desire blinds.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And if desire blinds, then you're unaware of what's feeding you.
Right.
You're unaware of what you're eating.
Yeah.
So there's this aspect where we're literally, like what he's revealing is this cannibalistic nature of how we'll operate, because the things that he is saying stop doing or don't eat of that, those things are killing you.
Yeah.
We're choosing to eat of them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You're eating of dead flesh to just keep feeding flesh.
Yeah.
Versus letting him highlight the desires and the things that could be out of alignment.
Yeah.
And it just like, is that making sense?
Yes.
Like, it's just,
yeah.
Ugh. And it all kind of just accompanies with this mindset of like, well, I can do this because it's not going to kill me.
Yeah.
Or he's not going to kill me. So I can just keep getting away with it until, like, what? Like, you literally die.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, unto what? You're dying. You're dead. You're eating dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, if you think about cannibalism and you see it in the context of like the word and throughout different things, you can see it in 2 Kings, you hear it in Leviticus, you hear it like throughout with, it's directly related to disobedience and despair or desperation. So cannibalism is an outcome of sin or disobedience and inability. Oh my gosh, you guys, I'm sorry. Something else to think about is, and this is all just kind of graphic, but Mom has talked about life is in the blood.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's an aspect with cannibalism where they're drinking blood. And our DNA, Mom has said, is he takes life to give life.
Mm-hmm.
That is in our DNA. But what we're working out of our DNA is this aspect of we take life to give ourselves life.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Yep.
So if there's life in the blood, we're working out that aspect of continually feeding ourselves this life in the blood, trying to give ourselves life. So even going back to the serpent on the pole, one of the things that I think we could just briefly touch on is that there's this mystery and understanding that he used a serpent to cure from a bite from a serpent.
Yeah.
So the thing that kills you, Yahweh is using to bring you life. And so if we can't see things in proper order, it's like there's an aspect of being able to carry his blood that genuinely will bring you life versus trying to take blood to make your own life happen. Like, is that?
Yes, it makes sense.
Okay. Because when we take life to give ourselves life, you're still in death.
Yes.
Yeah. You're not producing anything.
Yeah.
So a practical example of that, like just blind desire, a little bit more lighthearted, it's Christmas. There's this aspect of, like, at least with conversations that we've had with family, a lot of the response is, I know it's not, fill in the blank, I know it's not his heart, I know it's not maybe the fullness, or I know it's not, like, because we've broken it down. This isn't his intention. This is why. This is where it's coming from. This is the DNA of, like, what he said. This is where we need to be going. This is what we will honor. And their response isn't, okay. It's blind to desire of, I have something that I want to keep, and so I'm going to keep it, and I know it's not whatever, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Another example of taking lives ourselves would be like allowing the next generation to suffer so that you can thrive in selfishness.
Yeah.
So if you think about like a kid being raised up, you can either raise them or not.
Yeah.
You can choose to raise them in a way of being able to be dependent or independent.
Yeah.
And either way, if you're raising a son or daughter to be independent, like mom has shared about this before, she raised her kids to be independent. And that was killing of herself. Because all a mother wants is to be able to have somebody who's dependent on her,
yeah,
who you can care for, who you can nurture, who you can look after. Mm. But mom knew that's only going to get them so far.
Right.
Yeah.
So instead of raising dependence, she raised independence.
Yep.
So taking a life of the next generation to fuel your own life is the cannibalistic nature of the things that he's after in us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're like bypassing the desire and what you're bypassing the desire to be awakened to what is in front of you. One other example would just be like the shift in leadership. We talked about how there's going to be a shift from the rescue preservation cycle into a more mature state. Staying in a cannibalistic nature would look like sucking the life out of your leadership, which is kind of awkward because I don't mean to say that. But mom and dad sucking the life out of your leadership to where they're literally drained.
Yep.
Because we want to feed the selfish desires inside of ourselves instead of maturing.
Yeah. That's good.
So I'm trying to bring some practical examples because this isn't a, if I were a cannibal, it's you are a cannibal. We are.
Because that's where we came from.
Because that's what we've come from.
Yeah.
And this is what he's walking us out of.
Yeah.
So he's been speaking to, you are dead.
Yeah.
And I feel like he's giving us, like the angel in the pathway, wake up. You have to wake up and see where you are, the state of your nature, or you will be dead.
Yeah.
Like dead, dead.
Dead, dead.
Not selfless dead.
Yes.
Dead, dead.
Yeah.
So, cannibalism, again, is a result from disobedience and desperation. So if we know that fear comes from an incapability of something, fear is a catalyst to that desperation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there's a reason why he's telling us we have to address our fears.
Govern.
We have to be able to govern them. Because if we cannot govern our fears, we will continue to stay in despair, which will lead to disobedience. Being in his will safeguards that desperation.
Yep.
So us choosing to stay blind to our own desires versus his is what's going to keep us in our own will. That will keep us in that cannibalistic state versus being able to see his will is what safeguards us from that.
Yeah.
So we have to continue to lay down our flesh, which hits different.
Yeah.
Lay down the flesh that you're feeding on.
Yeah.
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 So that you can mature into something that's actually feeding you life.
Yeah.
So when he's talking about playing off of each other, the way I'm hearing that now is feeding off of each other.
Yeah.
So if you have an issue and it's playing off of somebody else, you're just feeding off each other.
Yeah. Yep.
That's good.
Are you guys seeing that?
Man, gross.
Super so, and I hopefully that's not coming off like you. I know I keep saying you, but I had to work through a lot of things this week in the sense of fear and things and being able to address fears. Because if I am in despair, like there's no despair that could come up any louder than if I'm in fear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fear for me, it just brings like the most loudest form of despair I can do, because there's no way for me to be capable of fixing it unless I walk through it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in order to get out of that cannibalistic state, you have to go through death selflessly, the selfless death, going back to the two types of death, the selfless death to get to the other side of that.
Yeah.
One other thing that he had said that I just think is really powerful is Mom and Dad have always said this is a matter of life and death. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we can take that almost nonchalantly sometimes, of this perspective of like, well, okay, but all that means is that you're not seeing. Because if you could see, then you would recognize it's life or death.
Mm-hmm.
So if it doesn't feel like it's life or death, then you need to ask to be shown or to have whatever he did for Balaam so that he could see the matter of life and death that's literally in front of you in every single decision you make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know, I'm just thinking like the definition of despair. You mentioned despair. Despair is the complete absence of hope.
Yeah,
there's no way out.
It's like desperation is recklessness arising. It's a state where all hope is lost or absent.
Huh. Okay. It's a whole new perspective on flesh.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
Welcome. Don't hang out by the guardrails and we'll be fine. At some point, you won't need guardrails.
Yes.
Work myself out of a job.
Good.
Thank you, guys. That was good. I'm gross.
Sorry.
Gross. Laying down your flesh.
Mm-hmm. And thinking with each other. I heard that term.
What are we eating? It's gross. I want to go back to donkey for a little bit.
Wash your mouth out.
What is the donkey in our lives? I know Jason touched a lot on this. What's that thing that just won't move, the thing that frustrates us, or who is the donkey, what or who, the thing that keeps us from that goal, that ambition, the thing that crushes our foot, gets us mad, we pull out a sword, we're going to kill it, makes us look like a fool, like a doofus, like other people. What is that? Who is that thing? I know we can all think of something. And yet that donkey is keeping us from living a reckless life unto death. And a lot of this I'm quoting from the actual Torah portion. And he says, reckless, reckless. And it also made me think, because obviously we got to pick who we are and which character are we. I'm obviously not the donkey. I started thinking about the donkey, like the donkey was more righteous. The donkey was more aware. The donkey was more submitted, right? And I just thought that was interesting. Like the donkey knew even. And yet sometimes the donkey is what's keeping us like in the guardrails. Literally keeping us alive. Because like, what did it say? Like that Yahweh was literally becoming the adversary. He had his sword drawn. Have we turned in our lives? Are there moments, or is there a moment, or are we in that moment, where we turn the presence of Yahweh into our adversary unknowingly because we're so unaware of ourselves and the reality around us that we've created for ourselves to the point where we have become blind? It's literally what I wrote down.
Yeah.
Literally become blind. And yes, this word is for you and me. We beat the donkey, but the donkey is the very thing that saves our life from Yahweh literally killing us. So I want us to just, I think it's good to reevaluate our motives again and examine our goals. Take a step back and review the road we're on. Why we're even on the road? Is it reckless? Do we think it's what we need, what we want? We transition into the month of Tibet. So this is also First Fruits Giving today. And it's kind of interesting because it says it's a month where we evaluate our alignments and the things we've made covenants with, our commitments to. It's a month. It's also a good month to fast. So we can purify our blood so that our heart and our mind think clearly and function properly. So I wanted to take an account or a census, like literally sometime this week, take an account or a census of our goals, of the alignments we've made with people, with certain things, with certain commitments we've made. Write down the donkeys in our lives. Because maybe that's just Yahweh's grace in disguise, keeping us from sabotaging ourselves. So, it's the month of Tibet. I want us to also give. I think the bucket's coming around. But also give your first fruits and take some time as we transition to the month to really think through our alignments. And is the road we are on his ambition or our ambition? Yeah. And the donkey that we're beating really the thing that's saving us? If we can just see like the donkey. If we can just be like the donkey. And believe like the donkey. And fall to our feet right there like the donkey. I think that would really push us a little bit over the edge a little bit more, especially moving into this month where we are evaluating the things that we've made covenant with.
All right, you guys, I know we are still getting our elements, but as we do, I just want to send us into our time. I feel like there is a pretty literal application, which I'm sure everybody's feeling, moving from what Amber released into communion, which if the word for life is that he takes life to give life, or that there has to be death for there to be life, then the fullness of death is what we're meant to eat of, right? So,
yeah.
So we're learning how to not feed on things that continue to promote death when death was fully given so that we could follow after a son who knew what it meant to fully die so that there can be a fullness of life.
Yes.
And the part that's been missing in us or in religion or in application of salvation is in order for there to be a fullness of life, I have to die. I have to die to my flesh. I have to die to my ambition. I have to die to my own desires. I have to die to my will, which was freely given so that I could be bound to him and fully live. But first, there's death. So when you engage in his death, you are engaging in your life. But you can't take the gift of life through his death and then just continue to feed your own dead state.
Yeah.
Right? It's like receiving life and then saying, thank you for this. Now I'm gonna continue to just stay in a state that keeps me from being able to fully access this. That's the point.
Yeah.
So this free will offering, which is what it was for you, this was a free will offering he gave of himself freely, is meant to be followed by you to freely give your life in response to this gift, which starts with your death.
Yeah.
Right? Which is what we're trying to. We're trying to shift out of what we've known as living, right? And he's like, no, actually, the things you've been living for are what's killing you and keeping you from being able to receive this fully.
Yeah.
So as you drink and as you eat, engage what it means to allow death to be what precedes life because you've known it. This isn't a new sacrifice for you, but it is a new mindset to receive it from, and it is a new heart's position to activate it from a place where you're willing to follow. Because this used to represent, okay, pretend I'm drinking, pretend I'm eating. I don't want to actually engage it out of this mindset, but this is what it used to mean. I'm free. I'm free to live my life and live it in the way that I choose because of this death. But this death was meant for you to follow, right? That's what they're talking about in the going through something, or what mom and dad have spoken to as far as going through or seeing through to the other side, so that on that other side you can finally embrace life, right? That resurrection life that we're still trying to figure out. To me, it's still literally just a term. Like, I don't understand because I haven't yet fully died to what I've known so that I can live. I don't understand that resurrection life, but I know that it's on the other side of me letting go of that system that I've known and fully engaging this. So when you take this, when we have the opportunity to do that, it's literally you're consuming death, but you're actually drinking and eating of that gift of life. So there's just such a perspective shift that we get to, I don't know, I just feel like communion has become so much more than tradition, especially growing up in the Catholic Church, it was so traditional, and I didn't understand what it meant to engage this, and even more so now that he's walking us out of death's system, am I able to recognize how much life I'm being offered when I drink and when I eat? So engage that as you take your elements.
Okay. I'm just going to voice a couple of things that was stirring, honestly, from the week, the portion prior when Dad preached, which is why, and maybe Jason said this because we had gotten on after he started talking, maybe Jason said this, but they took on kind of my heart of what I would do in picking up on some of the things that, you know, Dad will get a word and then he highlights that word, but I'm more of like a line by line. So I was mesmerized by re-looking at the snake on the pole. We've heard that story. We hear it all the time. You learned it in Sunday school. We know that Yeshua commented towards it. I want to say it's also in Hebrews. Like it's a big part of the gospel, but we get to relook at it. I feel like everything we're doing, we get to relook at it. I don't know how many of you, I'm going to fast forward, but in last night's Torah portion, how many of us have heard sermons that he'll even use a donkey? That's like a typical, like he'll even use a donkey. Like I've literally heard it. I might have even have said it. Like he'll use an ass if he needs to. but we're not understanding the context. If you say that, I'm kind of jumping ahead into last night's Torah portion, but if you say that, that means that what you're speaking to is that you, I'm trying to think of how to explain this without getting into a whole teaching. If you say he'll use an ass, that means that you're saying he needs a donkey to speak to witchcraft. Not he'll use a donkey to speak to the Israelites. The Israelites aren't even a part of the story at this point. They're completely not even kind of a clue into what I'm talking about with spiritual warfare. What were the Israelites focused on at this point? Acknowledging their sin and walking rightly. That's it. They had nothing to do with this whole story over here. And yet we've said he'll even use a donkey, which he will, but the purpose of the donkey speaking was to speak to the one that was carrying out the enemy's plans. I just think that that's fascinating, that we've literally been told, like, he'll use anything to speak to you, and it's like, be careful. Like, it's a good thing. If he's using anything to speak to you, maybe it's because you're operating in sorcery. Because they had direct access to Hashem. He was the voice, and Moshe was the voice. Anyways, I kind of just jumped ahead. Anyways, go back to the snake. Go back a Torah portion ago. I want to read this to you guys because I feel like I don't have the proper words. There's been, over the last couple Torah portions, remember when I don't remember which Torah portion was, I got up, I said I need to be animated, and I talked about how Satan is all the way, not Satan, death is all the way over here, I'm using my hands, to the left, and, or to your right, and life is all the way to the right, which would be your left, right? That's the opposing kingdom. There's life, and then there's death. And one way to look at it is death and life are outcomes of which trajectory you walk through. So Yahweh is obviously standing over life, and Satan is standing over death. But Satan isn't the opposer. It's death that's the opposer. Satan is just the accuser of the brethren for you to attach itself to that system, to walk through it, and then essentially, because of the accuser of the brethren, you sin, or chicken or the egg, you sin, so you're accused, and because of that, then, you are now in death system. So going back to that, what I've been trying to release is the mystery of the two deaths, because it's not like you've just, at face value, you can choose life or death. But we know that the way to life is also through death, which means you've got a detour. You don't get to stand in your junk and then You don't get to stand in your junk and say, well, I'm just going to magically take it, no detour, and I'm just going to go straight to life and walk into the Holy of Holies. Like, you're just, you can't. So, because your fault or not, because of Adam and Eve, you have to take a detour, which means you have to go, sorry, I'm trying to keep this picture up. You have to go to the right. The detour is you have to go and follow Yeshua, who, in my opinion, has the ability to walk. He's the only one that's been able to, Yahweh, well, oh, that's another whole thing. Oh, my gosh. I don't want to be long-winded. I'm always long-winded. Yeshua, and this is my picture. Yeshua can walk back and forth because he's conquered it. So you have to take your detour. Let's say you're standing in the middle. You have to take a detour, follow Yeshua to death in order to get to life. So then there's two deaths. You can either stand through Satan in the system of death and have death, or you can follow Yeshua through selfless sacrificial death in order to get the keys to overcome death to have life. That's the two different deaths that we've been talking about. So I feel like this quote is huge, and this has to do with the snake on the pole. Okay. What lesson did he intend for us to learn from this? That God deals with sin, listen to this, not by taking it away, but conquering it through its own methods, through death. That's what I was talking about a sting operation. Now, you guys understand what I mean by sting. Of course he takes away the sins of the earth. That doesn't negate everything I've been saying, that he is a God who takes away. That's not what this is talking about. What this is talking about is that God deals with sin not by just eradicating it. What I mean by that is a flippant, well, I'm a magician, and since I put the snakes there as a punishment, I'll just take the snakes away. They repented, take it away. The picture of Christianity is, this would be the Torah portion. They sin, snakes come, they repent, snakes go away. That's not what happens. He takes the snake, puts it on a stick so that you have to look at death to be healed. So that you recognize that sin has been staked. So death conquers death, which I'm pretty sure is what I said and what I preached a couple of Torah portions ago, not knowing that this Torah portion was coming. Does that make sense? He doesn't just take sin. He does take sin away, but through a method. So that's what I want to make sure you guys are understanding, because I've said he's the God that does take away. He takes the sin away, not by just taking the sin out of the camp or taking the snake out. He stakes sin in death. Okay, let me just keep reading. God deals with sin not by taking it away, or yes, by taking it away, but by conquering it through its own methods. Again, the sting operation. Using the enemy or using death's own methods in order to conquer it. Which is what I've been saying, for us to be so familiar with it that we use its own methods to conquer through death. God wanted us to learn that our sin causes death, and that only through death can we live. He intended for us to see that he would make life possible for us through the death of death. So the two deaths are essentially combining when you operate in the death of death. Is this making sense? So you have to put death to death, and that is what brings life. It's like in English, like a double negative makes a positive. So death of death is essentially the same thing as life. So you have to go to death to put death to death so that you can have life. Thanks. So, I just feel like that quote is huge. So when looking at that Torah portion, remembering that Torah portion, that he doesn't just take the snakes away like a magician. He wants his people to remember the sin that you operate in is the method to your death. But if you will stake it, well, you'll look upon his method, his instruction, look upon it, that death conquers death, then you'll have life. And when they did that, they were healed. He didn't take away the venom. He gave something that gave you your healing, which again is a foreshadow of Yeshua. But this is what we've been talking about. You can't just use his name and slap his name on it, and then something just goes away. You have to look upon and receive in faith that death conquered death for you to be able to walk in life. So anyways, I just feel like that Torah portion stamped this whole sting operation thing about the two deaths and death having to conquer death, which is what is so amazing. When we went beyond over Hanukkah, we had talked about that death gets thrown in the lake of fire, and it's death that is being judged, you know. And some of the questions that have come of, well, you know, Yeshua, you know, he says, why have you forsaken me? And, you know, it's not that they were against each other. It's that he had to feel the fullness of what death conquering death. He had to actually go through all that. He couldn't avoid death so that he didn't say, Yahweh, you forsook me. Well, it's like we look at that scripture and we'd be like, well, okay, then that just justifies that Yahweh is against Yeshua and he had to pour his wrath. Like he's this big bad dad and he had to put his wrath somewhere. He did have to put his wrath somewhere, but not because of humanity or people. He did have to put his wrath on something, but not, he had to put his wrath on death. But we had to take on death for him to put it somewhere. I don't know. Does that make sense? Like he didn't just have all this wrath, like, he wasn't just conjuring up all this wrath and he had to put it somewhere. So he took it out on Yeshua so you don't have to endure it. It's not like they were against each other in that way. It was a sting operation. They both had wrath against the enemy, against sin, against unholiness. Wrath's probably not even a good English word, but he had to experience the fullness of death in order to conquer death itself. So, anyways, that's going back to the snake thing. So I just wanted to add what I was getting stirred in. And then I'll have to get back on about the whole spiritual warfare getting put back on the table. But I kind of jumped ahead when I was talking about the whole donkey thing and recognizing within this, well, I could just do it now, but within this Torah portion, we see a glimpse into Balaam. But all you see is a glimpse, and you kind of see a guy that's kind of confusing. Does he serve Yahweh? Does he not serve Yahweh? He listens to Yahweh. He's obedient to Yahweh, but he's also getting enticed by a group of people to, like, curse and be God's enemy. And then this weird Yahweh lets him go, but tells him to speak. So now is he a prophet of God? Like, who is this? Well, we know from multiple scriptures looking forward, including the New Testament, Balaam is not good. Balaam is the enemy of Yahweh. He is he operates in witchcraft and is a sorcerer and is in divination. Am I saying that right? Divination? This is so important. I feel like it's going to be so important. And why I'm getting heightened that spiritual warfare is getting put back on the table is because we're dealing with witchcraft. But isn't it confusing? He kind of hears from God. Doesn't that sound like our history? Christianity kind of sounding like God, prophets of God sounding like Yahweh, and yet we don't know if they're operating in divination. So I'm not going to get into it, but I just feel like this was the prelude, or not prelude, but like the opening to, let's put spiritual warfare back on the table. And I kind of hinted at it when I said, where were the Israelites in this story? What were they focused on? Because I think that that's going to be key for us to understand spiritual warfare. Anyways, let me know if that's making sense in adding to last night. And that gives us a hint as to why Yeshua is the ultimate mediator, because he has the ability to go back and forth. And he has that ability as a human. So when he says you're supposed to do greater, it's why we are so not subject to sin and death, because we should be able to touch it and influence it in the other direction versus the other way around. See how the character of Yahweh changes? He's not pinned against his son like he's the bad guy and the son's the good guy. It's through Yahweh, who became a human, that gives us everything that we have. It's the same. That's why I was saying I was going to go off on another teaching. It's the same person. It's Yahweh himself that said, here, let me operate in this sting operation to really overthrow a system. So I'm going to clothe myself in skin, clothe myself in humanity, because we are made in his image. So we're one and the same. But I'm going to go into that system to teach them how to be able to go back and forth.
Thank you for listening to this message from Kingdom Heirs International. If you have received insight and revelation with this message, we invite you to claim that revelation by trading on the trading floor with this ministry. You can do that at kingdomheirsflag.org. Thank you.